First today to the solemn plans that always accompany big upcoming battles. And there's a big one being planned. Could the long-awaited liberation of the northern Iraqi city of Mosul from its IS or Daesh occupiers be nigh? The most recent briefings from senior American military sources in Baghdad suggests the operation could start in about a month, but let's not get too excited just yet. The media has been loudly predicting an imminent start to the crucial operation since early 2015, only to be proven wrong. But some real momentum seems to be developing in the Nineveh province in northern Iraq, painstaking preparations to ready the Iraqi security forces for the battles they'll face, both against the enemy and against divisions within. I saw, by the way, that the Iraqi army's tank commander particularly praised the Australian trainers for helping them prepare better special fighting skills. Equally important as the liberation, what happens next? The post-hostilities phase is getting special emphasis. It might suggest some big lessons have been learned all round from the recent past about the need to win the peace, as it were. Now, as with many of these plans, the devil's in the detail. So to offer some informed specifics, plus to outline the big challenges at hand, I'm delighted to welcome the leading military analyst, well known, I think, to RN listeners, Dr. Anthony Cordesman from Washington's Centre for Strategic Studies. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Do you see this operation around Mosul starting within a month?
In some ways, it's already started because you've seen a very steady build-up. There's been a shift from a campaign that was focused on cities in the southwest, which were relatively small, in an unpopulated area surrounded by desert, to the area of Nineveh, as you mentioned. Now, that's a much more populated area. And to actually liberate a city, you need much larger forces. So you've been moving in Iraqi army units. You've been developing positioning on the part of the Iraqi Kurdish forces. They're all moving to a position where they could move forward in Mosul. And the question of timing, I think, in many ways, is going to be dependent on how well can they cooperate. What happens as they move forward into the urban area, whether they encounter stiff resistance or only limited resistance, and how much air power support they need from the countries in the coalition that are providing the air support that allows the Iraqi forces to defeat ISIS.
The air support seems to have been critical in some of the deployments thus far in Ramadi and Fallujah. So is there any question about whether they're going to get sufficient air support?
The numbers won't be the problem, but to have effective air support to fight in an urban area, and Mosul is a really large city. Some estimates put it at over 2 million before ISIS invaded. You're fighting under very different conditions. And the forces that Iraq has are relatively small compared to a city this large. One key question is how well the forces that are going to be deployed can use air power, how well they can move forward when precision airstrikes are provided. Another issue is how much ISIS resistance there is. An official spokesman put the core ISIS resistance at only about 2,000 to 4,500 people. But that number of fighters in an urban area where they've had months to have booby traps, use human shields, develop all kinds of barriers, tunnels, special access routes, it's not an easy fight, and particularly because the Iraqi army, although it's better trained now, is still a relatively weak force.
Yes, I noticed that the Iraqi news just overnight, quoting a source saying that ISIS had deployed something called the Grey Battalion, an elite security formation formed by Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, its leader, at the main entrances of Mosul because they were afraid of internal collapse in the ranks of IS. Some suggest they expect this to be their last stand, as it were. These are people who will fight to the death for sure.
I think one has to be very careful about all of these assumptions. We simply don't know. They've had posturing like this before. In some cases, they seriously stood and fought. In others, they've made all of these announcements, and then they've retreated very quickly. At least in one case, you had this almost horrifying picture of their retreating in vehicles while they use civilians as human shields on either side of the motorized convoy to protect them from air power. There's just no way to know until you actually engage. And one great problem here is that you can't afford to have the Iraqi forces break, and you can't afford to have them divide and to have tensions or conflicts between them. Coordinating this is a major challenge. And certainly groups like the Australian Special Forces, the U.S. Special Forces, the Marine Corps are going to have to play a critical role, not simply in the air, but on the ground, in trying to coordinate the Iraqi forces and make them effective.
And so what is your assessment? Because you've been writing about this. Can it work?
The problem is it can work, but you want to have very large amounts of force. You want to know how well the ISIS forces will actually fight and how effective given elements of the Iraqi army, the Kurdish Peshmerga, the various militias will be. This isn't something where you go in with a rigid battle plan, you suddenly move forward and everything is over in predictable ways. And with the advisory effort, they're going to be testing, in some ways at least, how well the Iraqi forces perform. They're going to be certain that there are plenty of supplies. And the other problem is that there are some estimates that this fighting can drive nearly 1 million civilians out of the area. So you have to figure out exactly what's going to happen to protect them. You have to be ready. And as you pointed out at the start, as you begin to liberate the area, the question also arises, how do you deal with the civilians as they come back? Because so far, Iraq has failed every time it really had to deal with the problem of the aftermath of a battle.
That's the winning the peace. And I want to come back just a moment because it's obviously critical. But when they do enter Mosul, I mean, are we going to have sort of Berlin, end of World War II type street-by-street liberation, hand-to-hand fighting? Is that what it's going to be like?
Well, what we have seen so far has been very localized fighting of that kind, nothing that would be large enough to cover an entire city. At the same time, what we have seen is a lot of damage from booby traps, from explosives, the use of civilian shields again in selected areas. ISIS tends to retreat into core areas of cities simply because they don't have that many fighters, but they can be very, very destructive. The question really is, at this point, will they actually stay and fight? Are they as motivated as they once used to be? Is this actually for them the final battle? Because remember, we are focusing here on Iraq, but the capital they have is in Raqqa, inside Syria. There's no real border in terms of defensive barriers. And there are large areas of desert, agricultural areas, river barriers that they can disperse in. And they may not want a last battle that destroys their core capabilities. In other times, in other ways, they've dispersed, basically preparing for a war of attrition.
But we'd know a bit about that already, wouldn't we, or would we not? Have there been intelligence showing that there's a sort of significant bleeding of fighters into the surrounding countryside around Mosul?
Well, you wouldn't expect to see that now. You would expect to know once there's actually an advance. This is a very large city. ISIS still controls some of the major lines of communication into the city. They don't have to make a decision until the fighting really begins. Now, they may choose to do it, but they certainly haven't left yet. What we have seen, however, is they put fighters into places like Libya. They've moved them into other areas. So, again, there are some contradictory indicators, and it is, I think, very likely that they will lose Mosul, but how quickly and how easily is something that I think even the best intelligence officers simply can't predict.
And Anthony, once that happens, let's hope it does, what about winning the peace? What do you see as the key challenges that the holding forces will need to overcome?
I think the critical for issue immediately becomes, this is a city where there will be immediate need for food, for security, for medical care, for emergency economic aid, a need to reestablish government services, but services that can deal with what could be hundreds of thousands of people coming back and wanting to have something approaching a normal life. It isn't simply a matter of security. It's providing services. It's providing all of the conditions that people will see as the road to a normal life. And that's one of the areas where Iraq has remained very, very weak. It is rated almost universally as one of the most corrupt governments in the world and one of the least capable. And so far, that's been the track record when it has had to service and provide help to civilians. Certainly, all of the countries aiding Iraq are trying to make it different this time. But that's not a task that military forces can perform.
Quite, but there is some evidence, is there not, that the Sunni, and Mosul is largely Sunni Muslim, whereas of course it's a Shiite government in power in Baghdad, that there is some recognition inside Iraq at last that this has to be better managed. Now, I don't know how you read that. I was reading that interesting briefing, very much trying to read between the lines. The commander of the Combined Joint Task Force operation called Inherent Resolve, and that commander was clearly indicating that there was a lot of priority being given to people working safely together. And I read that very much as code for Shiite and Sunni working together. What's your assessment?
Well, that's what we're trying to accomplish. I think that the reality is that there are still very serious tensions between the Kurds and the Arabs as to who will control what parts of Nineveh, whether the Kurds will go back to the areas which are largely Kurdish because they've advanced into areas for the first time which are not really Kurdish around Mosul. There are tensions because there are factions on the part of the Shiites that basically want to send in their militias, want to establish control, and be sure there aren't splits in efforts by the Sunni Arabs to create some kind of federal or independent structure. There are still factions within the Iraqi army. There's a battle going on right now within the Sunnis. We are trying to bring order to this. We're trying to ensure that civilians get support. But we have been trying to bring order to this situation for years.
Well, now, you might have noticed that former U.S. General David Petraeus wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post recently talking about the big interim provincial council that was set up in 2003 during the Second Gulf War, precisely this reason you're talking about, that it included representatives of every district in Nineveh, of every major religion, absolutely breathtaking array of people, civilians, and of each major tribe. He suggested that did work.
Well, it lasted and it worked for about a year and a half. But between 2003 and 2005, the arrangements broke down. And at the point when it was announced that the U.S. would be leaving at the end of 2011, you had a situation where you basically quietly had to put U.S. forces at the checkpoints between the Iraqi army and the Kurds. You had serious problems with the Sunni governor of Mosul. And remember that in 2003-2004, you still had something approaching a normal economy. There wasn't a fight up in the northwest. Now you have had ISIS occupying this city for several years. It doesn't really have a functioning economy. It basically is going to have to develop one, and develop one at a point where Iraq is nearly bankrupt because of the cost of the war and the fact that its oil export revenues are only about half what they were 2 years ago. All of these factors interact.
I just want to end with the Kurds. We often forget they're also quite divided, and they now occupy large areas they never previously controlled, including those oil and gas fields you're alluding to. They don't want to relinquish those territories, very hard won by the Peshmerga, their extremely effective fighting force. Is that just another curveball to be added to this scenario you're painting?
Well, it is certainly another curveball, and the problem again is there's no secure border here. Mosul is up in an area very near the border with Syria. The Syrian Kurds have somewhat different objectives from the Iraqi Kurds. ISIS can come back unless Raqqa in Syria is stabilized. So all of these factions in Iraq have a mirror image in other factions in Syria, and all can affect the city, which is very close to the border.
And we haven't even mentioned the Turks yet, because the Turkish forces are in there too as part of the coalition. In a very interesting development. Anthony Cordesman, I do hope we can come back to you. Thank you very much for your time today, for those overviews.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Anthony Cordesman, who's from Washington Center for Strategic Studies, and he has served as a consultant to the Departments of State and Defense during the Afghan and Iraq wars. He's written so much we cannot tell you at all, but the latest one's Lessons of a Modern War, a four-volume series. And just given that he mentioned Syria, I also noticed Joshua Keating in Slate writing some very interesting material about whether we are watching the war in Syria come to a close. Heartbreaking for the people of Aleppo, but there's a military stalemate there, which, if you look at history, ultimately can bring civil wars to an end.